From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And let's get the latest on the situation in Charlotte, North Carolina, where police and protesters confronted each other for a second night last night. One protester was shot, and the governor has imposed a state of emergency.
At a news conference this morning, Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Chief Kerr Putney said the family of Keith Lamont Scott will be allowed to watch police video of what happened when police fatally shot Scott on Tuesday. The chief said the video does not definitively show that Scott, a 43-year-old African-American man, pointed a gun at officers. Then there was this tense exchange between Putney and a reporter who pressed the chief about releasing the video to the wider public.
On the one hand, you're saying we should have full transparency. On the other hand, you're saying you're not going to release the video. How can you square those two things? Obviously, the idea of full transparency is release the video so we can all see it.
Sure. I appreciate your passion, but I never said full transparency. I said transparency, and transparency is in the eye of the beholder.
Well, joining us is Sarah D'Elia, reporter for NPR station WFAE in Charlotte. And Sarah, let's start with what we just heard. I mean, what kind of pressure is Chief Putney on to release this video to the wider public?
I would say that he has a fair amount of pressure on him at the moment. People in Charlotte are asking questions about this video and what it exactly shows, if it's going to answer any questions, if seeing the video and opening that to the public would maybe quiet down some of the protests and the violence that we've experienced in our city over the past couple of days. But you've heard that Chief Putney is pretty adamant about only allowing the family to view the video and not release that to the public at this moment in time.
Mm. Now, just to clarify, Keith Lamont Scott's family says that he was not carrying a gun when police encountered him. Police have said that they did find a gun. Is what the chief said today that the video does not definitively show that Scott pointed a gun? Does that contradict anything that we've heard in the past couple of days?
There are two stories here, what the family has said and what people in the neighborhood where the shooting took place a few days ago. They have one side of the story, and then CMPD, the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department, they have their version. And it seems like they're sticking to that version, which is that there was a gun, there wasn't a book, which is something that a lot of people have said, that he didn't have a gun and was holding a book. So there's still two very different sides of the story and events of what's happening, and we're still waiting to hear the details as the investigation goes on.
Mm. Now, given the second night of protests that happened in Charlotte last night, what more did city officials say this morning about perhaps imposing a curfew?
So that is an option, that because of the state of emergency, that CMPD can impose a curfew. At this moment in time, they say that they don't want to do that, that that's not something that they have planned for this evening, but it's something that they have, you know, the option to do. And that's what Chief Putney said as well. He said, you know, it's not something that we have decided on right at this moment in time, but we could make an announcement based on how things are shaping up for this evening if they do want to impose a curfew.
Hmm. Now, the images from the protests last night included, you know, scenes of protesters and police officers and tear gas. And, of course, as we mentioned, one protester was shot. And then today, I understand that Charlotte Mayor Jennifer Roberts also said that the city is open for business. Hmm. Tell us more about what she said.
Yeah, she did say that the city is open for business. The bus lines are running. There are places that are closed in Uptown Charlotte. I mean, we have some museums and some other businesses that have sent us press releases saying that they are not going to be open. And then there are other businesses that say that they have given the option to their employees to work from home if they don't feel comfortable venturing into Uptown Charlotte. So technically it is open for business, but there are individual institutions and buildings that have closed their doors for the day.
So what is the mood like overall in Charlotte today?
It's sad. We're sad. It's not good to be in the national spotlight for this. And it's our hearts are heavy in Charlotte, and people are really frustrated. People are really angry. I think on both sides. I think CMPD, they're doing their investigation. They're doing their due diligence. But the people of Charlotte are, frustrated, and they're looking for some answers. So I would say there's a mix of emotions, from anger to sadness in Charlotte today.
Hmm. Well, that's Sarah D'Elia, reporter for WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina, bringing us up to speed on the latest after a second day of protests, or second night, I should say, last night in Charlotte. Sarah, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, just 46 days now until Election Day. Let's get to our weekly district profile. And today, the House district we're focusing on is one that could make a difference for Donald Trump. It is Maine's 2nd District, and a recent poll finds Trump ahead there by 10 percentage points. Because Maine splits its electoral votes, he could get one from that district, even if he loses the state. In terms of the congressional race, it's a contest between incumbent Republican Bruce Poliquin and Democrat Emily Kane. And Steve Missler is our guide. He's chief political correspondent for Maine Public Radio. He's in Augusta. Hi, Steve.
How you doing?
Doing well. And tell us about this district, because this is the one that Donald Trump actually might win because Maine splits up its electoral votes.
Yeah, that's right. It's the largest congressional district east of the Mississippi. It covers about 27,000 square miles and comprises about 80% of the state's total land area. And there's probably 665,000 people here, which in Maine, that's quite a bit because Maine's population is just over 1 million. And it's one of those districts that's truly it's purple traditionally. I mean, prior to Bruce Poliquin held the seat, Democrats have held the seat for 20 years. And before that, it was Republicans who held the seat for 20 years.
And we know that Maine's Republican Senator Susan Collins is not voting for Donald Trump. Is Bruce Poliquin endorsing Trump?
If he is, he's doing it privately because he actually refuses to say Trump's name, or he's refused to do that up until this point. Hmm. The press has been trying to get him to say one way or the other, and he basically said that the topic is off limits. And I don't know what, you know, right now we have some recent polls that show that Trump is doing well here. So maybe Bruce Poliquin will at some point will come clean with his support of Donald Trump. But right now he just won't even address the issue.
Well, let's listen to him. This is him at a town hall event in Auburn last month, talking about the state's opioid problem. Here he is speaking with WGME TV.
My late brother had problems with substance abuse for 35 years, and he was a great guy. We loved him to death, and our family did everything humanly possible to help him, but we made mistakes. A lot of the times we didn't know who to call or where to turn to.
So opioids have been an issue in the campaign. What else has come up in this race?
Well, other than that, I mean, a lot of the campaign has been almost a personality contest between him and his opponent, Emily Kane, who he faced off against 2 years ago. I mean, these two were vying for an open seat. And so really it's been almost like a personality contest where they're both trying to paint the other as somebody who doesn't live in the district or doesn't know the values of the voters from that district. It's very much a campaign about who's the outsider.
Well, let's listen to the Democrat now. This is Emily Kane holding a town hall for seniors earlier this month.
I'm proud to be endorsed by the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare because of my strong record standing up for seniors in the State House for 10 years. I bring to you experience when it comes to balancing our state's budgets and working hard to make sure that we have communities where you can live and you can thrive for a very long time.
What more can you tell us about Emily Kane?
Well, she was the House Minority Leader here when Governor Paul LePage was first elected. And that put her in a very interesting position because the Democrats were forced out of power in the State House or lost their majorities here for the first time in a long time. And so the big question was, is how are they going to deal with Governor LePage, this sort of bombastic, a very powerful sort of figure? And how are they going to deal with him? And she kind of created this image as somebody who could work with him in some ways while also being a good foil for him too. And that relationship has actually surfaced during this campaign where she had put out an ad touting her ability to get a tax cut package, which was actually really, you know, vehemently opposed by a lot of members of her caucus, but ended up passing. And she has touted this achievement during that ad and as a way of saying that she can work with him.
So what are the polls saying about this race?
Well, the polls are tricky here because we don't have a lot of good polling in the 2nd Congressional District. We just don't have a large sample size. But what they have shown so far is a pretty close race, but with Poliquin with a pretty good lead. I mean, he won here 2 years ago with a 5-point margin of victory, which is pretty good. It's not, you know, it's not a walk, but it's also it wasn't a nail biter either.
That's Steve Missler, chief political correspondent for Maine Public Radio. And what a political year it has been in Maine, Steve, especially with your governor. So thank you so much for joining us.
You bet.
And all this week, we're talking about climate change. Today, we want to look at possible solutions. First, what you can do. Brenda Eckwurzel is director of climate science for the Union of Concerned Scientists and author of Cooler, Smarter, Practical Steps for Low Carbon Living. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
And let's start with the cars that we drive. How important are fuel efficient cars or electric cars or giving up cars entirely if you want to lessen your carbon footprint?
Sure. If you drive, and if you drive what an average American drives, which is about 10,000 miles a year, it's the single most effective step is to switch a car to get better fuel economy. For example, if you were to upgrade your car that got an average fuel economy of 20 miles per gallon and instead had a more fuel-efficient car that's 40 miles per gallon, you could save over the life of that car about 4,500 gallons of fuel. Hmm. And if you were doing $3 a gallon, that's putting over $13,000 in your pocket. Luckily, in our country, we have an established aggressive fuel economy standards, so all Americans are going to save money at the pump.
And if I have a car that gets about 30 miles a gallon, right in the middle of your two examples there, is that something where you would say, well, you really, if you can afford it, you should try to get a more fuel-efficient car, or is that pretty good
Absolutely.
For right now?
I mean, to be honest, if only a few cars on the road are getting 40 miles per gallon, one of our clean vehicles engineers told me once, he said, I would be much happier if a truck that is gets an extra little bit of, say, an extra 5 or 10 miles per gallon, and more people are driving trucks over long distances, that could go a really long way.
What about the food that we eat? How can we make sure that that is as climate conscious as possible?
Sure. It really comes down to thinking about where your food comes from. So what we find is that, for example, a pound of beef would be equivalent to 18 pounds of pasta regarding the climate, the harm to the climate. So when you're thinking in those terms, what we did was we crunched the numbers over consumer habits for all the things that Americans do, from eating, what you do in your home, going to the doctor and so forth. And what we found is those three things that you honed in on are how you get around, how you heat and cool your home, the energy use in your home, and food.
And when it comes to food, it's all about red meat, or are there other things as well?
Well, it's mostly important to know the source of your food. What really matters is how that beef was produced. If it's produced with a lot of grain and corn and a lot of fossil fuel tractors driving, a lot of water needs, it's different than a grass-fed cow, for example. So knowing the source of your beef on the farm, emissions are bigger with protein of that size compared to getting it to your table. Whereas vegetables, eating local vegetables makes a bigger difference. But vegetables in general are very low carbon footprints compared to beef.
So what about the other thing that you mentioned, which is the energy in your home? What should we be thinking about there?
All right, all you listeners out there that may have a refrigerator that is older than 1993, you really have to get a new one.
Hmm.
That's when there, and this is where standards at the federal level make a difference, and good engineering. There was a increase in efficiency of refrigerators from 1993 to afterwards. It was increasing about 70%. So for older refrigerators, that was the largest energy use in the kitchen.
We've also heard that you shouldn't leave things plugged in if you're not using them, like even a television, that these new TVs that take up a lot of energy.
Yeah, there's a fun jargon term for this one. We call it phantom power. So, for example, I really don't need my TV, my microwave, and everything all night long having those lights on. We just don't need them. So, for example, the television, what we do is you have one of those power strips, plug in your television, all the remote devices that you're feeding into it, and you just turn on that one rocker switch when you want to watch television and turn it off the rest of the time you're not doing power.
I feel like if you were to ask somebody, you know, are you doing what you can for the earth, they would say, oh, yeah, I recycle. So how important is recycling?
It's interesting. We looked at the recycling, and you'd be surprised what is the most important thing to recycle from a climate standpoint by slowing the pace of climate change. Would you like to guess what it is, or you want me to say which one it is?
Is it aluminum?
You got it.
Wow.
Exactly. Aluminum cans. All aluminum. It takes so much to extract that ore and get it to market. It's a lot of energy use. So we're going to be mining our landfills in the future for some of these precious metals. Really. It's going to be – that's closer to home, and it's better than extracting the raw ore.
That's Brenda Eckwurzel, who is Senior Climate Scientist and Director of Climate Science for the Union of Concerned Scientists. Her book is Cooler, Smarter, Practical Steps for Low-Carbon Living. Brenda, thanks for joining us.
I enjoyed being here with you. Thank you so much.
So what about big picture solutions? For that, let's bring in Steve Cohen, Executive Director of Columbia University's Earth Institute. And Steve Cohen, do individual steps make a significant difference, or do we really need massive changes to fight climate change?
I think we need everything. I think we need individuals to take those steps. But then there are systems level changes that we need at the local level, the state level, national, and also international.
Like what? If you could wave a magic wand, what would be the first thing that you would do to deal with climate change at a macro level?
Well, let me start with the easiest thing to do, because the easiest thing is we can waste less energy. I don't think anybody's going to oppose energy efficiency, and Americans in particular waste enormous amounts of energy. When we transmit energy from wherever it's generated to wherever it's used, we lose upwards of 25%, sometimes as much as a third of the energy that's generated. So if we developed, and this would take a large-scale change, a smart grid technology where we use more of what we have and we build a more intelligent system, that's going to save energy. If there's a single thing that I think we really should be focusing on, it is to make solar energy, solar cells more efficient, possibly through the application of nanotechnology, and to continue to focus on battery improvements. Because the problem with solar power and wind power is it's intermittent. If we figure out a way to store it, suddenly solar energy, which is basically zero to generate, becomes cheaper and cheaper, and it will drive fossil fuels from the marketplace.
And what about the issue of the food that we eat? And in particular, I'm thinking of cows and all the methane that they produce.
Well, these are the tougher problems. And frankly, if you look at it on a global level, I don't think that's really the heart of the issue. We could certainly make our diets better, and I think many people are doing that anyway. The focus on wellness puts you in that direction. But I think that what we really have to do is move away from this idea that solving the climate change means you have to sit alone in the dark with a candle. We can maintain and even enhance our lifestyles by becoming more conscious of our impact on the environment and moving to technologies that allow us to do more with far less energy.
There are issues of transportation. Where you are in New York City, there's a major public transportation network. Not every place has that right now. Would it make a difference if they did?
Well, we in America have developed, unfortunately, a very dispersed lifestyle. So we're going to be reliant on personal transportation. So if that personal transportation is electric and the electricity is largely generated by renewable energy, it won't be that much of an issue. But what we also can do is have a system where you can ride a bike to a bus or to a train, and you can do ride sharing so that five people are in the car instead of one. I mean, there are so many things that we can do by just simply altering how we do some of our transport.
How important a solution is something like green buildings or even urban farms?
All of this is very important. But there's a limit to it. What's really important about it is that people are now paying attention to what they're eating. Some vertical farming could be very effective because you could actually close the system of production. There'd be no waste going into the aquifers. You could limit the amount of water. Those are technologies that are going to develop over time. I think what's really good about what's going on now is people are thinking, what am I breathing? What am I eating? What's the quality of my water? When I was growing up, nobody thought about any of that. And I think that's a dramatic change in how people are living today.
I remember speaking years ago to a scientist who was talking about the idea of launching basically sunglasses into space that would kind of block out the sun to a certain degree and buy us some time. it's a solution that would not happen. But are there kind of crazy magic bullet solutions out there to deal with climate change?
Yeah. I mean, the idea of carbon capture and storage is not that crazy. It's just expensive. But I think that the single approach that I think would make the most sense is putting some serious government money into the basic research on solar cells. You know, if someday the solar array isn't $15,000 and the whole roof of your house, if you have a suburban house, but is half of a window that you can put in an apartment, and that solar battery is not $5,000 and occupying a whole wall, but it's the size of your laptop, then suddenly you start to have distributed generation of energy being a real possibility. When I was in graduate school, the computers that we used were the size of a small semi and had less computing power than your iPhone.
Right.
So the idea here of shrinking and making more efficient the storage of solar energy is not crazy. And somewhere in a basement in Hong Kong or maybe in somewhere in California, some kids are figuring out how to do this.
Steve Cohen, Executive Director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
There's just 1 week left, just a little over a week, I should say, in Major League Baseball's regular season, and that means the race for the playoffs is reaching a crescendo. Here and Now sports analyst Mike Pesca is here with the latest. He's host of the daily podcast, The Gist. Mike, welcome back.
Hello, and thank you for saying crescendo, not fever pitch, as would be the cliche with this sport.
Well, we try to avoid cliches whenever possible. We're late in the season now, and the Cubs are the only team to have clinched a playoff berth. So how dramatic is the final week and a half shaping up to be?
There's drama. I would say maybe it's B-movie or Pulp Fiction drama. But, you know, Pauline Kael taught us all to appreciate B-movies. And this is what I mean by that. In baseball, all the division leaders are clear. And these are the Cubs who have clinched, but the Nationals and Dodgers are going to be clinching in the National League. And in the American League, the division leaders, Cleveland, Boston, Texas, they'll be waltzing into the playoffs. But then below them, a second tier, the B-movies of teams, and these races for the wild card, that's the ones that are really dramatic.
Okay, so who are you watching then in the wild card races?
Well, in the American League right now, if the playoffs were to happen today, it would be odd from a scheduling perspective. But Toronto and Baltimore would be in, and then under them, Detroit, Houston, Seattle, and the Yankees. They still have a chance. In the National League is kind of fascinating. There are three teams, the Cardinals, the Giants, and the Mets. They all have 80 wins. And I was watching the Mets last night, where down 4-3 to the lowly Atlanta Braves in the eighth inning, Yoenis Cespedes put a ball over the wall, but it was brought back by Matt Kemp in the eighth inning to prevent a tie. In the ninth inning, Yoenis Cespedes put a ball over the wall, and it was brought back by the center fielder Infante twice. He would have had a home run, but the Mets wound up losing, and that is why there is a three-way tie in the National League.
Wow. Well, let's talk about the Cubs for a second, because as we mentioned, they're the first team to clinch. Best record in baseball this season. I heard an interview the other day where a Chicagoan said that there's nobody alive in Chicago that saw the last time the Cubs made it to the World Series. So is this the year that their curse is lifted?
Here's the problem with baseball. Having a great record, unlike any other sports, really being a legitimately great team, it doesn't translate to World Series success. It's just the nature of the game. There is so much chance. In the NBA, the team with the best record usually wins. In football, the team with the best record correlates well to at least getting to the Super Bowl, often winning the Super Bowl. But the stat is, since baseball went to its current playoffs, there have been 26 teams that have had the best record in the regular season. That includes some ties. Only four of those teams have won the World Series, 154, a terrible batting average. So that argues against the Cubs winning the World Series. So does over a century of not winning the World Series. What argues for it is they are the best team. They are just the best team. And they're, I don't know if they're peaking now. They probably peaked a little earlier, but even without peaking, they're still the team to beat. Okay. But history shows they're beatable.
Okay. So do you dare venture a pick then for the series?
I would say they're most likely. I'd love to see a Cubs against Red Sox World Series, and this would be Big Poppy David Ortiz's last game, and he's a man with a sense of drama who knows how to deliver the big hit, and maybe he would go out on the World Series stage. But who knows? At this point, maybe the Giants, who have had the best record in the first half and have the worst record of any team ever to have the best record in the first half, I don't know, maybe they make it. I doubt it, but it could happen.
It could happen. Here and Now sports analyst Mike Pesca. Mike, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump meet in their first debate Monday night at Hofstra University on Long Island. The debate falls on the anniversary of the historic debate between two previous presidential candidates. It was September 26, 1960, when Republican Richard Nixon, then the vice president, met Democrat John F. Kennedy, then a senator from Massachusetts, in the first ever televised presidential debate. Here's Senator Kennedy in his closing statement that night.
If we fail to move ahead, if we fail to develop sufficient military and economic and social strength here in this country, then I think that the tide could begin to run against us. And I don't want historians 10 years from now to say these were the years when the tide ran out for the United States.
And here's Richard Nixon.
I believe that when we examine the Democratic platform, when we examine the proposals that he has discussed tonight, when we compare them with the proposals that I have made, that these proposals that he makes would not result in greater growth for this country than would be the case if we followed the programs that I have advocated.
Joining us now to discuss the history of presidential debates is Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School. He's with us from Princeton. Julian, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And I want to get to some of the history, and we'll be playing some more tape from the past. But first of all, your expectations for Monday night when Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump meet, this in itself is going to be a historic moment.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a big debate. Social scientists often say debates don't make that big of a difference. But the number of people who are going to watch this and the kind of fireworks that I think we can expect on the stage, given what we saw in the Republican primaries, might make this more significant than they otherwise would be. And they're going to, I'm sure, be very aggressive with each other.
And what do you think the strategy will be on each side? Are they going to try to get the other one on a policy, or is it going to be about getting a little soundbite that'll play over and over again on Twitter, or what?
Well, the most important thing in debates is not to make a mistake. And certainly Hillary Clinton, who's very seasoned, will be doing that, trying to avoid any semblance of an error. Donald Trump is more freewheeling, and we don't know exactly what he will do, but he will be provocative, and I'm not sure he's going to calm himself down that much. So I think each has a very different strategy. Obviously, Hillary Clinton wants to use this to communicate to the public more about herself, what she stands for, and to respond to this ongoing concern that some Democrats seem to have with her.
Okay, let's go back to that first Kennedy-Nixon debate. It was 1960. The Cold War was on. How did that debate affect the election?
Well, it used to be said that it was pretty decisive, and that when people saw John F. Kennedy, how he looked and how he sounded, it was such a dramatic contrast with Nixon, who had his 5 o'clock shadow, who didn't look into the camera, who really seemed uncomfortable, that was why the election ultimately went one way or another. It's not clear that's true. People have responded that's an exaggeration. But it did confirm a basic impression that had developed about the two candidates and some of the excitement that had been generated about John F. Kennedy.
And after that debate, there wasn't another general election presidential debate until 1976 between Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter. Why not?
Lyndon Johnson didn't want to have a debate after the assassination. He himself was not totally comfortable being on television. Richard Nixon certainly didn't want to repeat what was seen as a big mistake in 1960. There were also regulatory issues about whether you needed to put all candidates on the stage that created concern. So, it's a new kind of event, and all these disincentives were enough to not have these debates. Gerald Ford really didn't have that luxury. And so, Ford really wanted to show the country he was more than the predecessor of Richard Nixon. And Carter was very good on television and in the media, and so he was very comfortable in this kind of format.
Although he was on the losing end of one of the most famous one-liners in debate history, as far as I can tell, which happened in 1980. Let's listen here to Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan. And this was right after Carter laid out a plan for national health care.
These are the kind of elements of a national health insurance important to the American people. Governor Reagan, again, typically is against such a proposal.
Governor, there you go again.
There you go again. Why was that line so important, and how much did it alter the race?
Well, it's a great example of where substance really isn't at the heart of these debates. It's your style. It's your mannerism. And you know, Carter had just given this long speech about how Reagan was this radical and he had been against Medicare in the 1960s and he was going to go after Medicare again. And just with a smile, with a laugh, and with the humor that Reagan was very good at displaying, he basically, for many Americans, knocked out the seriousness of what Carter was saying. And that was something that he was very skilled at. Again, did it alter the debate? Carter thought it did, but I'm not convinced that because of that line, that's why we get a Reagan presidency. There were many other factors at work that moved the campaign in Reagan's direction.
Now, Monday will be the first time that there is a woman on the presidential debate stage. We have had women in vice presidential debates, of course, Sarah Palin, and then Geraldine Ferraro. Let's listen to this clip from – this is the vice presidential debate in 1984 between George H.W. Bush and Geraldine Ferraro.
Let me help you with the difference, Ms. Ferraro, between Iran and the embassy in Lebanon. Iran, we were held by a foreign government. In Lebanon, you had a wanton terrorist action where the government opposed it.
Let me just say, first of all, that I almost resent, Vice President Bush, your patronizing attitude that you have to teach me about foreign policy.
Julian Zelizer, what does that tell you about maybe what Donald Trump needs to think about as he goes into this debate?
Well, you know, obviously the same kind of issue will emerge. How does he respond to her? How does he interact with her? His naturally aggressive style could create and replicate the same kind of interaction that you just heard. The thing about Donald Trump is he doesn't seem to care. And so if the past is any indicator, that kind of concern won't bother him. And he is willing to say something provocative, dismissive, being patronizing, and he'll just write it off later as not what everyone is saying it is.
As you say, the candidates are going to have to avoid mistakes and gaffes and looking bad when the other one says something about them. Let's listen to this moment from 1988.
I have as much experience in the Congress as Jack Kennedy did when he sought the presidency. I will be prepared to deal with the people in the Bush administration, if that unfortunate event would ever occur.
Senator Benson.
Senator, I served with Jack Kennedy. I knew Jack Kennedy. Jack Kennedy was a friend of mine. Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy.
Now, it's a famous line, and you can't see it on the radio, but one of the things I think that makes that one so devastating is the look on Dan Quayle's face when he is just being dressed down by Senator Lloyd Benson there. Your thoughts?
Yeah, there he was like a deer caught in the headlights when you watched it on television. That's the kind of one-liner that really is important in the debates, whether we think that's a good thing or not. And there are gaffes. Like you said, in 1976, you know, Gerald Ford was asked about Soviet domination of Eastern Europe because conservatives were criticizing him for being too soft on communism. And Ford said there is no Soviet domination of Eastern Europe. And the moderators are stunned by listening to the president say this. And he meant something different. He meant to say he didn't think it was legitimate Soviet power in that region. But it was the kind of gaffe that really cost him.
One more thing I want to ask you about, and that's the moderator. Listen to this. In 2012, Republican Mitt Romney criticized President Obama over not calling the Benghazi attack a terrorist attack. And then Candy Crowley of CNN weighs in.
He did, in fact, sir. So let me call it an act of terror.
Can you say that a little louder, Candy?
I was saying, he did. Can you say that a little louder, Candy, he says there. But do you think the debates, the moderator is going to play an important role in fact-checking this debate?
I think they have to. I think we are in a moment in political history where there's a lot of fuzziness, as some people are saying, with the truth, with fact. And I think it's incumbent on the moderators in this day and age to push back against candidates with what they say. They can't just let the candidates use this as a 90-minute opportunity to tell us their campaign ads. I think it will be a better event if the moderators are tough with the candidates.
Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School. Fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Tourism is a $3 billion a year industry in the scenic Finger Lakes region of upstate New York. The area is known for its wine vineyards, trout fishing, and around this time of year, leaf peeping. But a controversial plan to store byproducts of fracking operations in salt caverns on Seneca Lake has many residents concerned. Julie Grant from Here and Now contributor The Allegheny Front reports.
Driving around Seneca Lake, evidence of industry is everywhere.
You have to try our rosé.
The wine industry, that is. There are fields upon fields of grapevines, wineries, and tasting rooms nestled along the lakeside.
My name is Lou Damiani. I'm co-owner of Damiani Wine Cellars here on beautiful Seneca Lake.
Damiani grew up around here. He and his partner started clearing land and planting grapes in the early 1990s.
And realized the revolution that was taking place here in the grapes we could grow and the wines we could produce.
The region has been named a top destination for wine lovers. Many tourists also boat and fish on Seneca Lake, a deep and salty lake that supplies drinking water to 100,000 people. Looking out the tasting room window over the grapevines, Damiani points across the lake to the U.S. salt plant. He and others who work and live here are concerned about a project under consideration by the New York Department of Environmental Conservation to store fuels in the salt caverns. Salt is packaged and shipped out at the plant in Watkins Glen for pharmaceuticals, cleaning, and table salt. It's been mined under Seneca Lake for over 100 years. The company that's now called Crestwood bought U.S. Salt in 2008. Crestwood declined an interview for this story, but put me in touch with Mike Gilbert, a union worker at the plant.
I work in the shipping department. I've been here for about 15 years now.
Gilbert says to get the salt, they pump millions of gallons of water down thousands of feet into the caverns at high pressure. The salt dissolves in the water, then they pump it back up.
It's a brine. Brine is a liquid. It looks just like water. You wouldn't know unless you actually taste it that it's very salty.
The brine is stored in open ponds or pits. It's heated to evaporate the water. Crestwood wants to use the salt caverns to store natural gas and other byproducts from fracked wells in neighboring Pennsylvania.
What they're proposing to do is put propane down in there.
The company already stores natural gas in the salt caverns, and it wants to expand that capacity and also store 1.5 million barrels of propane. Gilbert says the United Steelworkers support the project. Crestwood plans to add up to 17 full-time jobs.
We are Seneca Lake! We are Seneca Lake!
But a lot of people don't think it's worth the risk. More than 600 have been arrested protesting Crestwood during the 7 years its storage plans have been under consideration. They regularly stand at the company's front gates. David Braun of California recently joined them.
I am risking arrest with you all today because of disasters with gas storage that I have seen up close. Don't let it happen here.
Braun is talking about a huge leak from Aliso Canyon outside Los Angeles, where natural gas is stored in depleted oil fields. It spewed methane into the air for nearly 4 months before being plugged in February.
Like the facility here at Seneca Lake, the Aliso Canyon facility was created from unlined holes in the ground that were never engineered to store anything, let alone highly pressurized, flammable gas.
The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has already approved the natural gas expansion project, and the New York Department of Environmental Conservation found last year that opponents have not provided adequate proof to back up their concerns. Meanwhile, Crestwood has responded to the community by scaling back its proposal, eliminating plans to store 600,000 barrels of butane, and reducing propane storage by nearly a third. It also dropped a controversial plan to bring in fuels by rail.
Sawmill Creek Vineyards, this is Tina.
But many local people are still worried about the project's impact on water quality. Tina Hazlett manages a vineyard here that's been in her husband's family since 1852.
We're already, Seneca Lake is the saltiest lake in the Finger Lakes, and it's because of those salt caverns.
She points to research that shows moving pressurized fuels in and out of the salt caverns could raise the salinity of the lake and make it unusable as drinking water.
They're telling people if you're young or elderly or have blood pressure, don't drink this water. There's no other water source. So, you know, what are people supposed to do?
But supporters of Crestwood's plans, including the county legislature where all this has been debated, say the only holdup is politics. They're waiting for Governor Andrew Cuomo, who's already banned fracking in New York, to make a decision. For Here and Now, I'm Julie Grant.
And we've got this final note. Terry Gross, the host of NPR's Fresh Air, accepted the prestigious National Medal of Arts and Humanities today at the White House.
The 2015 National Humanities Medal to Terry Gross for her artful probing of the human experience. Her patient, persistent questioning in thousands of interviews over four decades has pushed public figures to reveal personal motivations behind extraordinary lives, revealing simple truths that affirm our common humanity.
President Obama was also there to present Terry's medal. And congratulations, Terry. You're an inspiration to us all. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.